We'll fire it off right here. Welcome back to another episode of Off the Gas and On the Mic with Chase Holland. We have returning guest, Miss Janice Ferguson, and then we've got probably one of the best guests we're going to have on the entire podcast right here. I'm super excited to have Mr. Richard Ferguson on here to tell us some really good stories and kind of highlight some of the cool things in his life. So thank you all for coming back on, and we're super excited to get it rolling.
You're listening to Off the Gas and On the Mic with Chase Holland.
Thanks for having us, Chase, and what an introduction. He does have some good stories. I can't wait to hear them.
Yeah, especially before we ever got this fired off, he started telling us a couple stories. And man, if the podcast is like that, I'm excited. So, Richard, let's just kind of start with your life growing up and everything. What did it look like growing up as a child? You know.
Well, I grew up in over around Waco, Texas. I didn't grow up with a bunch of money or fixed up or anything like that. We did okay. My daddy was a diesel and heavy equipment mechanic. He was self-employed most of my life. Probably after, I think about 80, about 80, 81, 82, sometime frame like that. He bought his own shop, went self-employed, and I grew up basically working in a shop, cleaning parts for my daddy, things like that, small town. And later on, after daddy bought his big shop, we did a little better in life. He started making more money and things like that. So he done that for years and years.
How old were you at that point whenever y'all moved into the bigger shop?
I was probably around maybe 9, 10 years old. Probably about 9 or 10 years old. So life started getting better. We had a big old house over there in the middle of Waco. It actually had 22 rooms total.
Wow.
5 bedrooms, 5 bathrooms, a big old basement as big as a lot of people's houses.
It's one of them antebellum homes.
Yeah, with the big columns and stuff in front of it. All the family come to our house for the holidays, Christmas and Thanksgiving.
Did they stay for the holidays?
No. There might be a few people that would stay from time to time, but most of the family was still around the Waco area, so it was just one of them in and out deals. They'd come over and spend the day and visit, and everybody eat together and then they'd go on home. But that was kind of like my childhood, and nothing super exciting, but we did well. We never wanted for anything. Daddy always made sure we got everything we needed. We didn't always get what we wanted, but we had what we needed. And then after that, his shop got broke into, and Daddy was always one of those people. He didn't believe in insurance and all that. We had, guard dogs in the shop, and his mentality was you don't have to have all that insurance. It's just expenses and things like that. So we never even had health insurance growing up. You just paid out of pocket, and it had to be something pretty bad to even go to the doctor. But he got broke into, and they cleaned his shop out. I mean, by that time, I was probably 14 or 15 years old, and I had bought my first truck. It was an old Datsun. It cost me $300, all the money I'd saved.
Wow.
And they actually stole my truck and used my truck to haul some of my daddy's tools and equipment off. We had another 88 Ford in that shop that was daddy's truck or one of his trucks, and they used punches and knocked holes in the fuel tank, stole the fuel out of the fuel instead of siphoning it. They was too sorry to siphon the gas. So they punched holes in his fuel tank and stole the gas to drive on, I guess. And the moral of the story is he never got a single thing back. They caught the guys, and those guys had been running all over Texas to these swap meets, and they had sold all my daddy's stuff, I guess, early on before they got caught, and he never got a single tool back. And that kind of was the decline and my family, if you, you know, that for the lack of better terms, that was where we started kind of running into hard times. And it really got into, you know, it caused a lot of pressure in the family. You know, a man that spent his whole life accumulating tools and equipment and building an empire, for a lack of better terms, that hurt him, you know, and he just never probably really recovered from that. And
did he continue in the diesel mechanic business, or did he kind of step away from it after that?
He did. And I remember that Christmas after that. I remember it being Christmas, and you know, at that point, all the good times was pretty much over. That's my memories, because he was doing what he could do to scratch a living. He had to go borrow tools from other friends that had shops, and just to get the work out that he already had, you know, brought in to finish. He had to borrow tools and buy old cheap Harbor Freight stuff. You know, when you start getting a big wrench set, you know, you deal with all this.
Right.
You know, when you're used to working with all Snap-on and Matco and Mac tools, and you've got to reduce yourself to going and buying Harbor Freight tools to finish jobs, you know, that messes with a man's mind. And I remember that particular Christmas, it was cold. He wouldn't even run the lights, all the lights in the shop, because he was trying to save money, you know, cutting cost.
Wow.
And him being up there doing an in-frame overhaul on a big 18-wheeler just so he could get paid to try to buy us some Christmas. And, you know, those kind of memories stick with a person growing up. But it's an experience that what you try to take away from it is it's a life lesson. And you learn that this old world will beat you up and stomp on you and destroy you if you let it, or you can do what it takes to accept the challenge and come back from that. So we went through some tough times for a while, and my daddy, he come to the realization that maybe he didn't need that big old shop. Maybe he didn't need all them employees, and he decided to go mobile. And he got him one of them mobile trucks with a crane, one of those big trucks. And he actually moved away from the 18-wheelers, and he started working them big strip mines over there, working on big off-road equipment, big Moxie dump trucks and Tracos and all that. So that was the next phase of his life. He got away from the 18-wheelers and moved into the, you know, heavy construction equipment and started working all that. And I'd run around with him and help him when I could. And then, you know, that's when I got to the age where I had to start thinking about what I was going to do and what I was going to be when I grew up. I was in high school by then, and he got going pretty good again and was doing well. And all of us kids was getting older, and that's when I had to decide what I was going to do, and I didn't have a plan. And Daddy told me, he's, you know, I was always getting in trouble later on in my high school years. I was rodeoing and, you know, running around being a heathen and getting in a little trouble, drinking a lot, going to rodeos, chasing girls, all that good stuff. And he told me, he said, boy, he said, I don't ever tell you what to do. He said, I'll let you figure it out. He said, but you better figure out what you're going to do when you turn 18 years old and you graduate. He said, because you ain't staying here. You know, and as a teenage kid, I had no plan. You know how it is.
Right.
You just – okay, I mean, it's a surreal feeling when he tells you can't stay here. But one thing about my daddy is he never bluffed. If he told you something, that's the way it was. He didn't have a soft moment. He never went back to caving in. He always did what he said. And he told me, he said, when you're 18 years old and you graduate, you're gone. So I had to start considering what I was going to do. The problem was we didn't come from money. We weren't fixed up, so whatever was going to happen, it was going to be all on me to make it happen. And I was working a little old welding job. A local friend of his had a welding business, and I'd been working for him for a couple of years. And but I wasn't making any money, you know. I was probably making $7, $8 an hour. But I was learning a trade.
Right.
So I guess about – I mean, I'll be guessing, but probably a couple months before I graduated – He seen me, and I'd been, like I said, I'd got in trouble with the law a little bit, underage drinking, scrapping and stuff like that. And he said, hey, do you ever figure out what you're going to do? And I told him, I said, what do you mean? He said, I told you, boy, you're fixing to graduate and you're not staying here. I'm telling you, he would have put me in my truck and I'd have been gone. He don't care if I'd have slept in a ditch or in a parking lot.
Right.
He was proving a point. And I didn't know what I was going to do. Well, you know how it is when you're in high school and the recruiters are calling you nonstop.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I had never considered it. Well, that when Daddy had that conversation with me, it turned out the next day my recruiter from the Navy called me. And, you know, he didn't sound real spirited on the phone because I'd been telling this guy absolutely not for months and months. And he said, hey, this is so-and-so. Have you thought any more about joining the Navy? And I said, yeah, actually, come see me. I said, I'll join tomorrow.
It's time.
It's time. I mean, I had no choice.
Right.
And he said, do what? I said, yeah, come see me. I'll join. He said, are you serious? I said, 100%. So that recruiter come and see me at school. I took his little test, and he gave me my options, you know. And being that I was already in the welding field, he told me, he said, you know, you're qualified to be a welder in the Navy. What would you like to be? I said, well, what is there? I didn't know anything about the Navy. And he told me I could be a hull tech on a ship and this, that, and another. And I said, man, I don't really like the idea. I mean, I can swim, but I can't float. I said, I don't really like the idea of being on a ship floating around the middle of the ocean. I mean, right. I'm from Central Texas. We don't really do water like that. So he come back and he gave me a printout, and it said Navy Seabees. And I was like, Seabees? What's a CB? And I started reading that piece of paper, and there was a construction battalion. And in there was what we called a rate, which was your job. And it was a steel worker, and that basically was you as a welder, a fabricator, you erected metal buildings. It had a whole list of things that you would do in that capacity. And I said, man, and the good thing was you was in a battalion and you were land-based. You did land-based construction projects. I said, that's me all day. That's what I want to do.
So on land.
On land. So he signed me up, and that's where it started. I went in the Navy. Went through my boot camp training, and, you know, that was a joke to me because I had been raised up by a very hard man, so all that screaming and hollering and all that, it had no effect on me. I actually had a recruit division commander, asked me one time when they called it beating us. They didn't really physically beat us, but they would exercise us so hard, they would call him the Rain Man because the roof and the windows would be dripping from the condensation from all the heat coming off of us getting so-called beat inside what they called the ship, which was our barracks. And he asked me one time, he said, Ferguson, he's standing in my face. He's a little short guy. And he said, Ferguson, he said, are you prior military? Because you got to understand, a lot of people will transition from one branch to the other, or they did their time in, say, the Air Force, and they wanted to go into the Navy. So there was a possibility that I was already prior military,
right,
and was moving into the Navy. He said, are you prior military? I said, no, petty officer. And the reason he had asked me that is because I was like the Iceman. It's like all that stuff had no effect on me. I had been raised by the devil himself. What are you going to do to me? You can't physically beat me. Not that he couldn't, but he physically couldn't beat me. I didn't look at him as if he could. He was inferior to me in my eyes as a man. And what are you really going to do to me? So that's just kind of like what I put off, you know. Just nothing affected me. And I give all that credit to being raised by my daddy. You know, all the experiences in life and the bad situations I've seen him in, and the situations that I had been in my life, to me, things like that was just another day.
That was minor, yeah.
Yeah, so made it real easy for me, you know. A lot of people was panicking. A lot of people was, you know, it took them out of their comfort zone. Me, it was more of a aggravation that I had to have grown folks telling me what to do again.
Right.
That's the part I had to get past. So, yep.
So you made it through, obviously. And what happened after that? Where did they I guess station you after that? What did it look like?
So I went in. I went in and October 28th of 1996. I went through boot camp and I graduated. So something else you don't know is none of the holidays count towards your time in boot camp. So I went through Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, all in boot camp.
Wow.
You talk about.
In Chicago.
Oh, wow.
I could tell you some stories about boot camp. These fools, they were always telling you stupid stuff just to mess with your head. So one night, I'll get back to the point. I'm going to do a Trump, and I'm going to weave.
Yeah,
and
bring
I'll,
it.
And then I'll come back.
That's perfect.
Trump 2024.
Heck yeah.
So I'm sitting there one night, and Ferguson, yes, buddy officer, you got snow watch. Well, I'm like, here we go. Well, now we're going to go outside and freeze our butts off watching it snow. Just something stupid they're going to make us. Yeah, we watched it snow all right. We watched snow on end of them shovels all night, cleaning them sidewalks off. That's what that was about. So that's the kind of things you deal with. So now, moving forward, I got out of boot camp, and then I got my A school was in Gulfport, Mississippi. That's how I landed over here in this part of the world. And I forget how many weeks it was, but it was a steelworker A school. And little did I know, when I signed up for 4 years. Well, they don't tell you the extra 12 months that you signed up was for a guaranteed A school. That was to have that trade. Hmm. The part they don't tell you is, if you don't pass that A school, you get kicked to the fleet. And now you're just an undesignated seaman, and you're back on a ship and doing whatever they tell you. You might be chipping paint.
Right.
So when they told me that, I mean, I went in panic. But let me tell you something. I wasn't ever good in school. It's not because I'm stupid. I just, if it doesn't interest me, it doesn't interest me.
Right, right.
So I was like, oh, my God. Now I'm going to end up back on a ship if I don't pass all this. So I went into panic mode a little bit, and because I did not want to be on a ship and be out in the middle of the ocean. So I buckled down, and long story short, I got through it, and I actually graduated an honor student. That was a 90-something percent pass rate. So, you know, I got myself worked up over nothing.
Right.
So I went through A school in Gulfport and got out of A school. And my orders, they gave me two choices. I could go to California and be on an amphib, which now we're talking about water again. Or I could stay in Gulfport and go to battalion, which means I flew all over the world and went and done construction projects. So,
right.
I mean, without saying, I chose Gulfport, and that's where it all started.
Right. Well, is this? Give me a time frame of Miss Janice. Is this when you met her around about that time, or?
No. So, let's see. I go to battalion. My battalion had actually already flown to Guam, and I think they were there for 2 months. My first deployment after A school. So I went to A school. I had a little bit of free time. I think 2 weeks I got to take leave. I went home, got a little scrap over there, kind of relived my youth. And
I find that hard to believe.
Yeah, me too sometimes. So I had to go to meet my battalion in Guam. Well, man, I'm 18 years old. I'm from Central Texas. I ain't never done all this flying around by myself and having to figure all this stuff out. Well, I fly to Guam and I'm by myself. And the way the orders were, I was supposed to catch a flight in Gulfport, fly to Dallas, fly out of Dallas, fly out to LAX in California. Yeah, LAX is the big one in Los Angeles. Fly from there to Hawaii, and then catch a flight from Hawaii to Guam. That's a lot for me to digest.
Yeah.
Especially when I never flown anywhere. I went to Mexico one time on a senior trip. That's a whole nother story. But I had a group with me, so they could kind of, you know.
You had a guide to an extent.
I had a guide. Yeah, I didn't have no guide this time. Well, Daddy knew enough about it. He said, we're not taking you all the way back to Gulfport. We're going to catch your next flight in Dallas, because I was already in Texas. And I didn't know you could do that, but I trusted him, and that's where he got me on a plane. So I flew all the way, like I said, from Dallas to California, and then from California to Hawaii. Did I tell y'all Hawaii? Mm-hmm. That's where it went, to Hawaii. And then from Hawaii, we jumped over to Guam. And let me tell you, that's a long flight. It stayed daylight the whole time, it seemed like. I guess the way the time zones work. And we was on that plane forever. So I went to Guam, and that's where I met them, and they were 2 months in. So I spent 5 months that first deployment in Guam.
Tell them what you did on the beach in Guam.
Which time? when I eat the dog?
Oh, that's no. That's a delicacy.
Yes.
No way.
So there were some Filipinos vacationing over there, and we was always drunk and rowdy and doing whatever. We just did whatever. And there ain't much that I won't eat as long as it don't eat me first. And we were down there drinking and partying. These Filipinos, I couldn't speak their language, but we were friendly with everybody as right. long as they was friendly with us. So these guys, they had some big banana leaves laid out there, and they had a campfire going. And they were eating some kind of meat. So we was hungry. So I went over there, and I grew up in Texas, so I spoke a little Tex-Mex, but that didn't fly with them Filipinos. So I couldn't communicate with them. So I'm like, you know, hey, you share some comida? And they're like, they don't know what comida is. That's food in Spanish or whatever, the way we said it. So the guy's like, hey, you know, he's waving us over there. Come on, come eat. We weren't saying come eat, but he's telling us that in his language. So I go over there, and me and my buddy Kerry Adams, and there was a few of us, we start eating this meat. Man, I'm going to tell you something. I don't know what kind of seasoning, because it's stuff we don't have, but that was some good food. So we're trying to talk to this guy, and I'd be lying to you to tell you how we finally got it out of him, but I'm like, what is this? And we're trying to, you know, break the language barrier, and it come out, he does something like, woof, 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 woof. I said, that's a dog? Dog? Woof, woof, woof. And a dog run by. And I said, is that? And I said, oh. So, I mean, it's not a problem. It was very good, but I was right. thinking, wow, that's a first. But I'm going to tell you something. Let crap hit the fan. Ain't nobody's dog safe. I can tell you that.
What kind of dog was it? Was it?
A dead dog.
I mean, the one that ran past, I mean, were we Australian Shepherd?
No.
What just, we have?
Just old mutt. Just
okay.
Old Guam.
Just whatever ran past,
old
huh?
Guam, old street dog. So,
wow.
And that's probably his buddy that they had on the grill. them people's different, you know, in their countries, yeah. their cultures are different. They're not spoilt like us. When they get right. hungry, they eat. So, yeah, that was interesting.
So yeah, that's
so let you want to get impressive. Back to you want to get back to Janice where she
yeah
came.
Yeah.
So we got done with that deployment, and I come back, and I rode bulls all through high school and stuff, and of course I was a lot thinner. When I joined the Navy, I was 139 pounds and I was 6 feet tall, but I was wow. cock strong. I was real strong for my size and my build, always have been. So you know, I was a big tall. What you call tall for a bull rider.
Right.
But I loved it. So when I got back, I got my mama to send me all my rigging back, had all my chaps and my vest and my spurs and rope and bells and all that stuff in it. And she sent it to me down here in Gulfport. And I was on the search for a bull riding pen somewhere to ride, because I had this belief that I could continue on, you know, and everybody, you know, from where I'm from, they wanted to be a professional bull rider.
Right.
Either that or calf roper or whatever. But we always, you know, being that we rode rough stock, we always said ropers was, well, I'm going to be rated G on here. They were sissies. but we rode rough stock.
Right, right.
Well, the only place around here was a place that a guy named Dan Davis had up outside of Wiggins, Mississippi. He had a little bull riding pen up there, and you could go get on practice bulls. Well, I don't know, Janice, what was that, on Fridays or Saturdays?
I thought it was Sunday.
It might have been Sunday, but you went and gave your little $5 or $10 a head and got on all you wanted. And we go up there, me and some of my Navy buddies, excuse me. Some of them had ridden before, some of them hadn't, and they were trying to get into the sport. And we were up there at Dan Davis's, and this little scrawny girl with a big old – apple butt comes out there, and they running bulls up in the pens, and The next thing I know, I see this little girl sitting on the back of the bucking chutes, and I'm like, what the hell is she going to do? Well, what she did, she went over there and climbed down there in that bucking chute and got on one of them bulls, and I thought, here we go. So I'm not trying to be a chauvinist or anything like that, but where I'm from, girls don't like do boy sports.
That's not a thing.
Especially in the 90s.
In the
right, 90s. We're in a different time back then.
They didn't play footballs with boys or play football with boys. They didn't wrestle with boys, you know, unless something was wrong with them. But this girl gets on this bull. So I'm sitting over there like, yeah, this is going to be good. She's going to get herself all. Yeah, it's because you don't want them getting busted up. I know the reality of that lifestyle. And I've seen some bad wrecks, been in some bad wrecks. And I was thinking to myself, that girl is fixing to get herself destroyed, you know, and for what? Because her, you know, her buddies over here are misleading her and wanting her to go do this nonsense.
Right. Well,
he didn't know me.
I didn't
right,
know her.
Right,
I,
yeah.
I mean, first time I seen her. So I was kind of put off by it. And she gets down on him, and I'm going to tell you something. She rode him like Ty Murray. I mean, she had she had perfect form, and I mean, she was whipping that hand back, and you know, had them toes out, and I mean, made it look good. So, I mean, I should have been proud of her, but I was more like, oh, whatever. I mean, that's not what I expected, but good for her. So, that's the first time I seen Janice, and I seen her walking by there, and she might have side eyed me or something like that, but I didn't pay her no mind because I was still trying to get over the fact that she just spurred holes in this bull, and So that was it. And then I don't know how much time went by.
It was a month. Maybe a month and a half.
She's got all this stuff in her mental Rolodex. I'm just living life. She's over there keeping
That's keeping awesome.
Track. Well, I didn't think I'd ever see him again because I don't remember if I even went back there. But
so these cats over here, they would go over there and they would ride and they'd be in their old busted up Levi's or whatever britches they could afford and have their old t-shirts on. This look like a bunch of bums. And where I'm from, to be a hand, you got to look like a hand.
Right.
There's a level of, you know, you're not going to go to a dirt track race and pull up in a, I don't, how much one of these cars cost? Well, I'm not going to get into all that. It's probably a lot. But you're not going to pull up behind an old 67 Dodge on a regular old car hauler because people's going to judge you for that.
Right.
Well, much like that in the rodeo world, you don't come up there looking like a bum. You dress for the occasion. You're a bull rider. You come up there in a nice pair of chaps and Western
starch
shirt.
Jeans.
Starch jeans. All Texans, if you ain't got starch jeans on, you're probably not from Texas. So you're a transplant. So I dressed the part, so it made me kind of stand out over here.
Right.
Some people can call it a prima donna. I just call it looking good. You know? So she noticed me. Well, what'd you say, a month?
It was about a month.
It was about a month
later. It was the night before Thanksgiving that I saw you at that bar.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. So I'm at a bar, a local bar that used to be down here before it got all woke, called Michael's Nightclub. And that was the only country bar around here, which, you know, compared to where I'm from, it wasn't much of a country bar, but they played a lot of hip-hop music. Every now and then you'd catch a good song where you could actually dance with a woman. But most of it was that old line dancing music where the women sit out there and dance together, and some of them beta males would go out there and kick their feet with the girls. But, you know, all of us had to stand in the back and wait our turn for a real song to come on.
Right.
So we're sitting in there, and my buddies come over there. One of my buddies, hey, man, you see that girl over there in the corner? I said, yeah. She wants to dance with you. I said, okay. Well, I was sitting there chewing some Levi Garrett and drinking a cold beer. I said, well, I might dance with her here in a little bit when I get done with this beer. And I think they might have come and asked me again, hey, man, she's still wondering if you're going
to
come dance with her.
Because they wanted a cigarette.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't let them have one until you dance with me.
They was trying to bum cigarettes off of her.
That's so dumb.
Yeah. Things you do when you're young. They were trying to bum cigarettes off of her. I don't know why they didn't go buy their own cigarettes.
Just imagine, like, modern day, a vape or something. I'm trying to picture that if it was modern day.
Yeah, because when I was talking about it to you, I said I smoked, and you thought I was talking about pot.
Right, yeah. Yeah, you just, weed. You never know.
No, it was a Marlboro Light.
Yeah.
Right.
We can get into that conversation, too, about my opinion on these kids nowadays.
Yeah.
But anyway, we'll finish this story. So I finally she comes over there. I guess I'm not giving her the attention she's seeking. So she comes over there, and I'm sitting there chowing on some tobacco and drinking a beer. And she says, her little narrow butt comes over there and says, "You going to dance with me or what?" Oh, hillbilly accent. So her, the way she talks now, she's done been to college, and she's educated, and she's a businesswoman. She's evolved. But when I met her, that's the thing people will tell me all the time. They're like, how do you and Janice make sense? And I'm like, because you don't know the Janice that I met. We met when we was both kids, and she has evolved, and I've stayed in the Stone Ages because I like it. I love it. I'm at. And but anyway, you gonna dance with me or what? And I said, "Girl, sit your butt down." I said, "I'll dance with you when I get done with this cold beer." Like I said, I'd probably done drank two more beers, just putting her off,
right?
Because you know you got to understand the science of a woman. A woman wants what she can't have. So if you
and you knew that back then, yeah, huh?
I knew the okay. I knew the psychology of it. I'm probably the only unlicensed psychologist you know. So she. She sat down and sat there and stared at me and basically pressured me, kind of like you do somebody get off the pot. She sat there and pressured me. So I'm like, I got to get rid of her. So I said, all right, let's go dance. A song that I could dance to finally came on. So I grabbed her up and we went out there and we danced and she fell in love. And that's how it all started.
He stayed at that bar all night with us. His friends left him.
I was trying to be decent. I asked my friends. So she enjoyed the company, and we were having a good time. And, you know, where I'm from, partying's partying. You can do it till the sun comes up.
Right.
Till you run out of gas. So these girls, her and her friend Brandy, they had a routine after they'd party at night. They'd want to go eat at the Waffle House. And they said, "We're going to go eat when we leave here. You going to go with us?" And I said,
I love how he's voicing it over. That's awesome.
I said, "Yeah, I could eat," which I really wasn't hungry because I don't drink and eat. I'm either going to drink or I'm going to eat. So right. I said, "Yeah, I could eat." So I told my buddies, I said, "Look, I said, y'all go on without me, and these girls is going to give me a ride home, home being back to the base." And that one girl actually, I think, was dating another CB. And so they leave me, and they're mad about it because, you know, I ended up with the girls, and they ended up going home alone.
Right.
Girls, plural. You know, that's the way they looked at it. He got two of them. So. Two for the price of one.
I wasn't sharing, though.
She wasn't.
Right.
So we leave and we go to the Waffle House. Well, let me tell you something. Where I'm from, girls are a little more modest. I guess that's the word I'm looking for. They're modest. They try to be more reserved, for lack of better terms. Well, Janice and Brandy, they order fried eggs with the yolk and grits and whatever else was, maybe some hash browns, and they chop all that crap up on them plates and go to pigging out in front of me. And I wasn't going to waste a buzz. You know, I wasn't going to mess up a $40 buzz from all that beer I bought at that bar. So I sat there and watched, and I'm sitting there watching them girls eat, and I'm staring at them. And, I mean, they got it going. They're slinging it down. And I'm like, what kind of animals are these? I mean, these things right here can eat, and they're not embarrassed about it. They're not at all shy.
Had you realized at that point that this was Janice that you had seen, a couple weeks back or whatever?
Yeah, I knew it was the same girl. But I'll tell you something. Even though it struck me as peculiar, the way that she just was comfortable enough to do all that, I kind of, like, fell in love with it. You know, I was like, now this is a chick I can get down with, because I'm not into the prim and proper. I mean, it's nice and it's good to take around your family and all that, but I like a country girl that ain't afraid to do some living, because that's my personality. I want a girl that can get down with me and be involved in the things I'm involved with. So a man's perfect wife is a wife that'll help him get rid of a body. For, like, you know, we say that. If you got an old lady that'll help you get rid of a body and keep her mouth shut, you better hang on to her, because that is rare. And I just seen her as one of them girls. I mean, she was into what I was doing, and she was into what she was doing, and she did not care if I judged her. And that takes a level of confidence. So I knew for her to do what she was doing, she was a confident person, you know, on the surface.
Right.
We had a lot of getting to know each other to you know, realize all that. But on the surface, it seemed like she was a perfect kind of girl. And So we went, and they hauled me back, and there was no hanky panky or none of that. I mean, I was a respectful person. I wasn't one of them guys that went out there and tried to, you know, take advantage of women or anything like that. So they took me back to the CB base and dropped me out, and I went to my room, and you know, I thought that was it. And the next day, the one girl that was with her, Brandy, her at the time boyfriend or whatever, Bobby, he was in the military with me. He come by my room and he said, "Hey, Ferg," he said, "you remember them girls last night that brought you home?" I said, "Yeah." "Well, that one that you was with, she wants to know if you want to come to her house for Thanksgiving." Thanksgiving? I mean, where I'm from, Thanksgiving's for friends and family, so it was kind of weird.
Right, right.
And I don't know, I don't even know her. So that was kind of strange, but hey, whatever. What did I have to do? I took a risk. I said, "Yeah, I'll go to Thanksgiving with her." So she come and picked me up, and in a little borrowed truck that she was putting around in, because another guy she knew that was in the military had left it in her care because he was deploying and didn't want to, I guess, pay rent or whatever to have somebody store it for him. So he's like, "Hey, just hang on to this truck for me, and you can drive it if you want to." So she come and picked me up, which is not the way I roll either. I don't have women riding me around, but I didn't have no wheels, and she wanted me to come eat. So I had to do it.
Because tell them what happened to your wheels.
I rolled them when I went home on that little escapade after A school.
Yeah.
I went and picked it up at the body shop, and 2 or 3 days later, I rolled it 55 miles an hour in a ditch, drunker than Cooter Brown. So, yeah, I still think about that. That was a nice truck, 79 Ford, four-wheel drive, extended cab. I mean, it was one of these things that cruising the coast, people would have been, you know, looking at it.
Drooling over for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, and I rented it, and I had a built motor in it and everything, so a big block 400, board 40 over, glass packs turned down under the cab. So in those days, that would have been a nice truck.
Right.
But anyway, I had tore my truck up. So I went, and I walk in her mom and daddy's house over there, and old country, you know, farmhouse, big two-story country farmhouse on a little 30-acre farm, and all these people, and I don't really like people for the most part, but I'm walking in there, and I don't know anybody. And I don't even really know her. And one of her kinfolk, who was that?
Which one?
Asked you who I am.
No, right when we walked in, that was Aunt Jeannie.
Her Aunt Jeannie asked her, "Well, who is this, Janice Marie?" And she goes, so she didn't even know my name. She struggled for my name. So
I was in love with him, though.
So I had to introduce myself. And, so I saved the day and introduced myself. And look, I fell in love with these people. These people was good as gold. They were just old country people. You know, everybody there was just very invited. They didn't care that she didn't know me. They didn't care where I come from. They didn't care about none of that. I was a guest, and I was as much as family, you know, and that's how they treated me. So all that, you know, that kind of first impression stuff, it kind of stuck with me. Like, these people are my kind of people.
Right.
You know, they didn't judge me. They didn't act weird. They wasn't over there whispering in the corners. They just, hey, if he's with her, he's good. He's like family. And that's right. How they treated me. So we started dating. And we dated for, I think, about a month and a half. And, you know, that's where this whole story is going to change. You know, that's where it all really started. So.
Well, let's talk about that. So did you get, deployed again, right? And is this where... So I guess what I'm really mainly looking for right now, you were the crew leader in Sicily. When did that come into play?
So that was all later. That was okay. That was toward the end of my Navy career. So what happened was I was in what we call home port when I met her. We'd leave for 7 months, go overseas for 7 months, and come back for 7 months. We'd be in home port doing all of our training, our classes, our FEX, which is field exercise, and then we'd deploy for 7 months. It was 7 and 7 rotation back in them days. I think they done, you know, changed it now where these boys can be home longer and,
right.
and gone less. But it was 7 and 7 rotations. Well, I was – when I met her, I don't know, I was probably half to three-quarters of the way through my home port. Mm-hmm. And we was dating – for about a month and a half, and I get a phone call one day in my room, and she says, I can tell she's shook up, and which I hadn't seen that side of her because she wasn't no crybaby, and she said, "I got something I need to come see you and talk about. I know it weren't good, but I, you know, and I said, well, come see me and let's talk about it. She walks in my room and she just breaks down and she says, I'm pregnant and I don't know how I'm going to tell my daddy. And I just looked at her. I said, you're not going to tell your daddy. What do you mean? I said, I'm going to tell your daddy. And she just kind of like looked at me. Like, I could just look right through her head. Her eyes went blank. And she goes, you would do that? I said, who the hell else is going to do it? Like, where I come from, a man owns his responsibilities. And that's not her job to go tell her daddy. You know, right. She didn't knock herself up. And I'm going to be the, you know, the what these kids say nowadays, the baby daddy. So I'm going to have to get right with her daddy so I can be the new daddy.
Right.
And, you know, I'm going to be the new man figure in her life. And that's my position to get right with her daddy, not her position. So I told her, I said, set up the meeting. And I'd only seen them at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's the only time.
That's the first time I've seen them.
Because remember, I told you I've been spending every night in his barracks.
Right. Yeah, we were
shacking up.
We were sneaking her in there. She wasn't even supposed to be in there, but I was an outlaw. I didn't care. I'd sneak her in and sneak her out.
A lot of stuff happened in like a month. There was a lot that went down. And you weren't even there for 2 weeks of it because you went back home.
Yeah.
And then I was gone for a week, too.
We would have to do a whole nother podcast, and then we could get
into
some real details. But anyway, we went, and I didn't know, but her mama had done broke the ice and told her daddy before I got there. I was planning on doing all that revealing.
Right, right.
And I knew it was awkward when I walked in because he wasn't the same guy I'd met at Thanksgiving. He was all just, you know,
quiet
and happy and humble. And when I went in there, he was just super quiet, didn't want to talk. Just, I could tell it's like something was on this guy's mind. And I was like, you know, this was supposed to be a big old secret. And Janice come in there and she goes, my mama done told my daddy. And I'm like, oh, here we go. But he didn't react like I would have, and he didn't react like my daddy would have. I mean, it would have been bad. So he held it, you know, he held it back. So her mama was actually the one that did all the talking. So when we got done eating supper, they let us all eat supper and, you know, got all that out of the way. And then we went in the living room and we went to talking.
I bet that was worse than if it just would have came out right there.
It was, because it was awkward, because I'm ready to reveal it and go ahead and, you know, the way my brain works, if we're going to have a blow up, I ain't waiting until after school. We're going to do it right here in the classroom.
Right.
So I had to, you know, hold all that in, and I knew something was, you know, going to be said that was uncomfortable, and I was just ready to get it out of the way. So we go in the living room, and the best my memory serves me is it was her mama started nine-lining me, asking, you know, one thing that she asked me, she said, so Janice Marie's pregnant? And I said, she is. And she said, how are you going to take care of our daughter? And I said, I don't have all the answers for you today. I said, but I can tell you this. I said, there's people in worse shape than we're in, and they do just fine. I said, I'm so-and-so rank in the Navy. I've got, you know, I said, I'm going to marry her. That was another thing I told her. I said, you're going to marry me. And she said, you would marry me? I said, yeah, I'm not going to have a baby that ain't got a daddy. I said, you're going to marry me. And I told her, I said, she's going to marry me, and we're going to raise this baby together, and we're going to figure it out as we go. I mean, where I'm from, a man scratches a living. He does what he has to do to make things happen. You right. own your responsibilities. And a lot of people disagree, especially nowadays. These people nowadays, they don't have any commitment. They have no fight in them. Everything's about, you know, if it ain't good times, they want to run from it. They right. want, they're entitled. And I don't know where it comes from. It's kind of a disgusting society we live in, the way people are scared of a challenge. But, you know, men where I'm from, we view things a little different. Men are expendable. You place a woman on a pedestal. You right. place your kids on a pedestal, and your whole job, your whole existence, because that's what my daddy told me from the time I was a little kid. He said, when you have your own family, he said, all them little wants that you have and the future you thought you was going to have, he said, that all goes away. Your whole purpose in life from that point on, when you take on that commitment and start having kids, he said, your whole existence is about taking care of your wife and your kids and all your personal pleasures go out the window. He said, at the end of the day, if there's anything left over, you might can do a little something for yourself. He said, but in that moment, he said, every day, your whole job is to take care of that woman and them kids. So that was my mindset. And that's what I had planned on. I mean, I didn't know anything different. So we had a little old wedding down there at her family's golf course in the clubhouse. My mom and daddy and my oldest sister come over here, and one of my Navy buddies was my best man. And you know, her family that all came, they were very inviting, and you know, they'd come up and tell me, you know, if y'all ever need anything, let us know, which I'm a proud person. I never ask for anything. I'm going to figure it out. But it was a nice gesture for them to make. And, they welcomed me in the family. I didn't have any hardships as far as I didn't marry into one of them families where they treated me bad. You know, I was the guy that knocked up one of their family members and I'm an outcast. It was nothing like that. They just gave us room to do what we had to do to make our marriage and our new family, our young family, work. And that's how that all started.
So you got married before you had to go back out again, right?
I did. And we got a little apartment over in Gulfport, and we shacked up in there the rest of that home port. And it was in a bad neighborhood. Well, outside the CB base, but that was a bad neighborhood, and she couldn't stay there. And, you know, neither one of us had, you know, financially, we weren't at a point where we could, you know, be fixed up at that point. And all my BAH and all that stuff, I don't think it had kicked in, but it wasn't enough to get a real good start. And all this come on so fast, and before I knew it, I was deploying.
Right.
You know, the military don't care what your problems are. That's a you problem, not a me problem.
Right.
So I had to deploy. So she went and stayed with her mom and daddy, you know, and she never been pregnant before, obviously. So she was trying to, you know, learn, adjust all that. And, I mean, you got your mama there, you got your daddy there, and they keep her head straight and kind of, you know, help her out when they could as far as her husband being gone and being on her own and all that, cut down some of the depression or whatever happens with girls.
Right.
And, I went on my deployment, and we spoke every day. We spoke for hours at a time when I was off. And
I wondered about that. Y'all were able to communicate and stuff. I've heard of people not being able to communicate while deployment and stuff like that. I didn't know.
Yeah, so when I was in Bosnia, that was a different scenario. We were in a combat zone, and we didn't have phones or anything like that. So there was what they call, I think it was satellite phones back then, and we could communicate a little bit. But you was wait. They had two phones in this phone, what they called a phone tent. There was two phones. Well, we was there with the Army and the whole CB debt that was there. And you might wait in that line for 6 hours to talk on that phone, and then the line go down when you get in there, or that person not answer the phone. And you only had, I think it was 15 minutes to be on the phone, and you got disconnected. So,
and we were on a different time zone here, so I'd have to try to match his time zone, hoping when he was going to call me, because this is before, you know,
there wasn't cell phones
and computers.
There was no way to communicate. So you just basically, you waited in that line for your turn, hoping somebody would answer the phone when you called. So,
and I wrote him a letter. I tried to write him a letter almost every day.
Yeah, really?
I could.
But mail's shady when you're in a phone.
Yeah, I figured that would be rough too.
So, so that deployment, I left, I did my thing, and I come back. So
he comes back with a baby.
Yeah, I come back, and I had a little baby and a little daughter, Casey. And
are you excited, nervous? What's going through your mind at that point?
So what deployment was I on when Casey was born?
I don't know if that was Spain.
Whatever.
It was Bosnia. You started in Spain, and I think you went on a debt to Bosnia.
Yeah, so I was in Bosnia. Yeah, I was. That's right. I went to Rota, Spain, part of that deployment, and then I went to Bosnia and spent my last months in Bosnia. And on the way back off of deployment, that's when Hurricane George came through South Mississippi, and they held us over. We flew back out of Turkey or somewhere, and we went back to Spain and had to hold over till the storm got out. And Janice went to Keesler Air Force Base, and that's where she had Casey. And I didn't have communication with anybody. I didn't know where she was at, what was going on, because there was a hurricane going on. We had no communication. I was in the middle of deploying back to the home port, and I was in an airport, and a guy that was with me, he said, "Hey, Ferg," he said, "your wife had a baby." I said, "She's having a baby? What are you talking?" He said, "My wife's had a baby too, and they're in the same hospital room." And it was a guy I was on deployment with, so they both had their kids, and they were together. So he had actually got a hold of his wife because they had some form of better communication than I had. So that's how I found out in an airport trying to get home. So I got back several days, I guess, after Casey was born. Man, you talk about a deal that, that's all – that builds character in a person, all those kind of things, And I haven't thought about that stuff in years, but that's the kind of things in life that builds a person's character. You can imagine what that's like, but you can't really understand what that's like if you haven't lived through that kind of stuff.
I can't imagine the kind of stress and worry. And then after being told like she's had the baby, like my goodness, like the amount of like trying to figure everything out and there's nothing you can do.
Yeah. And that as a man, that's probably the hardest part is when your whole job is a protector, and to make sure that your people, your women, your kids are okay, and your hands are tied. You don't even have basic communication. You basically get neutered from your job, right. And as a man, that's very challenging on your mind.
He always had a hard time when he would leave because he couldn't control what was happening to us here and be there for us. And I don't think as a young person, I really understood what he had to carry being so far away with his responsibility that he felt so important to him. So it's definitely something that builds a relationship and you have to grow and learn through and you start to learn what's important to him so you can try to make it where you don't do things that make him worry about you. Cause I'm like to live on the edge. And even to this day, he can control, he has the ability to be around me. But when I leave, that's something that I have to take into consideration that it makes him worry.
Yeah, I'm stuck here taking care of all my animals and all that stuff because I have a different life now. And she goes off on this stone cold Steve Austin thing out in California for a week or two because they had, them sissies out there had their little strike and, didn't like their payment or whatever and wouldn't film it. So she had to sit out there and, now that's turning into my problem because I'm thinking, I got my mind right. She's going to be out there for a week. I guess it was like a week or a few days.
It was just a couple days. Turned it into a week.
Because they're on a strike. And I'm like, what is wrong with you people? Like, they're making my job hard.
Right.
Because now my wife is out in California. She's already doing – and if y'all are from California, you just got to understand the way my brain works. That's a weird place. There's a lot of weird stuff.
It's a terrible place. I couldn't imagine living over there.
Yeah, that's – California, so with all the weirdos, so I'm thinking my wife, and I'm just seeing these weirdos over there. I'm just seeing them taking advantage of my wife, and it's just, I don't know. And I know that wasn't what was really going on, but if it did go on, there's nothing you're going to do about it.
Right, right.
So that was tough on me, but she does all this stuff, and it does make me worry. But after you've done it for years and years and years, you have to get to a place in your mind to where it's no different than the wild stuff I do. I mean, I could go out there and get killed doing stuff that I do. And, you just got to get right in your mind that a person's got to live. And if they die, much like bull riding, if you got to accept that if I die or if somebody I care about dies, which in bull riding you're looking out for yourself mostly, but you got to accept if my wife dies doing something that she loves, then she died the right way. It's better than being an old, feeble woman laying in a bed, aching, having aches and pains and being doped out of her head on medicine and dying that way with somebody wiping her butt. At least she went out like a rock star. And that's the way I say it in my mind. Just like you in the race cars. If something happened to you, God forbid, in one of them race cars, you went out like a rock star.
That's right.
So.
Yep. Well, along the speaking on all of that, as far as the bull riding and stuff goes, can you tell us some stories and stuff about, obviously you've been wrecked. You've wrecked.
Oh yeah.
That's the terminology. What's been the scariest for you? Have you suffered any injuries that are with you today?
Yeah, they all stay with you. and you just, you know, I guess you look at them as battle scars, and you're just proud of them, you know.
Right.
You didn't get them being a wuss.
Right.
I've had tons of wrecks, and I've seen worse wrecks. You know, I've seen it all. I mean, I've seen guys break everything from, you know, legs and arms to ribs, and, you know, their ribs puncture their lungs, and they're over there turning white and passing out. I've seen a guy, Kyle, get stepped on his head and his throat, and a big old knot come out of his throat, and his little boy standing from here to that wall over there crying at the fence, screaming daddy. He's, you know, 5-6 years old, screaming daddy, and Kyle's over there doing a grandma seizure on the ground because he's got head trauma. I mean, I've seen it all.
Right.
As far as me, you know, I'll sum it up with the last bull riding I ever made in my life. I was out in Fallon, Nevada, and I got on a bull out there, and he wasn't nothing special. But the situation I was in, it went something like this. I rode him, and when I went to get off of him, I got hung up. I had to get off on the bad side, which the bad side's away from your hand. But, you know, that's just the way it happened. I got off on my bad side, and I got hung up to him. And that pen I was in, it wasn't a well-made pen. It was more of a practice pen at a guy's house, but you could go do little jackpot bull ridings over there.
Right.
And there was pieces of rebar and sucker rod and stuff like that sticking out in the pen in different corners of it, the way it was built. And that bull was running off with me. And any time that you get hung up, what you try to do is try to get him in a reverse headlock or something and stay close to him, because when you're out on the end of any of those shots, it's a worse shot. You want to stay close to him, so you're just getting roughed up and not really, really hurt.
Right.
So I'm hugging him around his neck, and I'm trying to get my hand out of my rope, and he's running me around that pen. Well, we got hung up for a while. I think we made a couple laps, and I'm trying to get my hand out. Well, I don't have any real clowns there. This is a, you know, what they call bullfighters. I got some amateur guys out there, and they're trying to get the bull's attention and get him to turn and stuff, but that ain't what I need. I need you to come over there and jump on his back and try to get my hand out of my rope.
Right.
And it wasn't working like that. So that bull's running down the side of that pen, and he got right up against the rails, and he's rubbing me down the side of the sucker rod. Well, what I knew is we were headed back to them bucking chutes, and when you get to that end of that pen, there's sucker rods sticking out in that corner, and he was gonna shish kebab me on them sucker rods, and I can't have that. So I did what's kind of against the rules. He come off the fence a little bit, and I did what I had to do, which is wrong, and I just made a run for it, like tried to snap my hand out of my handle on my rope. And what happened was, when I went out on the end of my arm, I lost all my play, and he blew up. And when he blew up, he jerked me up in the air, and at the same time he jerked me up, he jerked me into himself, and he throwed his head back, and his horn hit me in the eye and broke my eye socket, and I got 11 stitches in my eye, but it was enough that it knocked me off of him. It knocked me away from him, but it never knocked me off my feet, and it never knocked me out. That's one thing I pride myself with. I've never been knocked out in a scrap or by a bull.
Wow.
That's my Irish coming out.
Yeah.
Got a hard head. So daddy said, you got to be tough if you're going to be stupid. So
that's right.
I lived up to it. But anyway, he knocked me out of my handle. And all I remember was, I've been punched in the face by people and all that stuff. And I always tell people, when it don't hurt, that's how you know it's bad. And I know I could see out of my left eye, but I couldn't see anything out of my right eye. But what I could see out of my left eye was, every time my heart would beat, blood was flying out there on the ground. And to this day, my chaps are still up in my rigging bag, and they still got blood on them. And my riding vest still has blood on it. And every time my heart would beat, it was that old black, deep blood. It was pumping out. And I was like, well, I'm alive, and that's what matters. We can heal up. Yeah. I'm walking back to the bucking chutes, and that old boy, Richard, that owned that place, he says, hey, man, he said, you want to get that fixed up and get on another one? Like, where are you from? I said, no, bud. I said, let me go over there and get this fixed up. Like, I'm bleeding everywhere. I'm bleeding out over here. So I go back behind the bucking chutes. I didn't have anything for a medical kit. So I took an old sock out of my rigging bag, stuck it on my face, and I had some duct tape or some electrical tape, and I taped my head all up and put pressure on that. What had happened is it broke. It cut through my outer eyelid. It cut through all my muscle on the inside. The only thing it didn't cut was my inner eyelid, and it broke my eye socket. So all that meat was hanging out and hanging over my face. But I patched it up, and I told that boy Dan that I was riding with, I said, hey, let's go back to the base. You know, I was in the Navy at the time, and, you know, they got all these funny rules about destruction of government property and all that, and I didn't know what all the rules were, but we was fixing to find out.
Yeah.
So I go back to the base, and I go to the hospital, and that was Naval Air Station Fallon. Well, a funny thing, we're driving to the I'm a prankster anyway. We're driving to the hospital to go back to the base. And that boy Dan, he ain't never seen nothing like that. He wasn't even into the rodeo world. He just wanted to go watch.
Right.
So we're riding back to the base. And I'm sitting over there in the passenger seat of a Ford Ranger. It was his truck. And I said, I grabbed the door and I said, Dan. And he goes, what, Ferg? What? And I said, Dan. And then I went, this dude shit his pants. Excuse my French. This dude crapped his pants. He's all over. Oh, my God. He's screaming like a girl. He sounded like a dying woman. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And he was about to wreck. I could feel it. He was sloshing me around in that truck. And I said, whoa, buddy. I'm just messing with. Oh, he was crying. Literally tears. And I was like, that's the wrong guy. I mean, he was emotional. So don't ever do that to me, Ferg. I thought you was dying. I didn't know what I was going to do, man. So anyway, we get back to the base. And I go see the medical. The doctor that was on staff. And let me tell you this too. You know, you're in the military. These guys, these doctors, they're supposed to be ready for war.
Right.
You know, people get blowed to pieces. I go in there and this dude says, he's a military doctor. He says, hey, if I take that bandage off of your eye, is it going to be bleeding everywhere? I said, well, I imagine it is. It was bleeding when I stuck it on there. And by this time it's soaked in blood.
Yeah.
He says, I can't do anything with that. And I'm thinking, dude, I'm glad I'm not in a freaking war zone. Like, what are you going to do? Like, you got limbs blowed off people and you can't work on my eye? So they send me out in town to a hospital on town. And I go in there and the guy pulls my patch off and everything. He says, oh, man, that's bad. He says, I don't know if I can fix that. He said, I might have to care flight you to Reno. And get I don't know what they call those eye doctors, specialists, plastic surgeon or whatever to work on that. I said, look, doc. I said, I ain't cruising for looks. I'm already married. I said, you just put it back together the best you can, and we're going to roll with it. He goes in there, and, you know, it never hurt when I got headbutted, when that horn hit me, the back of that horn. What hurt was that dude coming there with a freaking horse needle. And that needle looked like it was about 12 inches long, which I know it wasn't, but he stuck it in my eyeball, like in my eyelid, and that was that deadener. And that thing going in there, it felt like he was puncturing through my brain and to deaden that thing. Now, once it went numb, we was all good. He sewed me up and everything, and we was all good, and my eye stayed swole shut for probably a week or so. But that was probably my – I've been hurt as far as – you know, I've been stepped on where, I mean, pretty much nearly crap your pants and pee yourself. And, you know, I've been beat up. But that was probably the most physically hurt that I've been as far as something that stayed with me, you know, broke my eye socket, which there's nothing you can do for a broke eye socket. It wasn't bad enough that they went there and put plates or nothing in it. But it was like, just let it heal.
Right.
And to this day, I mean, I got a little bit of a, it's not a lazy eye, but my eyelid, when I get tired, it'll sag a little bit. And I've got a scar on there. I don't scar bad. I got that good skin, but I can see it.
Right. Man, that's just crazy. Like, I guess the reason I asked that is I watched TikTok. It's like JB Mooney and stuff like that. And he talks about how he's been stepped on and the ribs broken and everything else, his arm completely hanging off and stuff like that. And I was just curious, like what you had been through on that side of it.
Yeah, those guys are a different level. You know, them guys are pro. I've rode in some pro shows. Well, they were PRCA sanctioned. I've rode against pro bull riders, you know, many times. because a lot of them guys, you know, back in them days, nowadays rodeo's a little different. You know, it's like any other sport. Everybody gets a participation trophy.
Right.
You know, they give out buckles for everything. Back then, if you won a buckle, you know, you done something. But these guys nowadays, and back then something else they would do. I remember the year, I believe it was in the 90s. Ronnie Kitchens, he was already riding in the PBR. And he came back to Waco, and we was in organization called CTYRA, Central Texas Youth Rodeo Association. We was kids, and Ronnie was older than us. But him as a PBR bull rider came to a CTYRA show and actually competed in the bull riding, which to me, that's sandbagging.
Right.
Like you're riding pro, and I think the next year he actually won the world.
really?
And it's like, really? I mean, that's sandbagging.
Yeah.
You know, you're coming to a kid's or a teenager's bull riding, youth rodeo, and you're competing. So there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on back then. It was a different world. I don't know that they still do that. And that's, so here's another thing about me. I never talk about that part of my life. I mean, you ask me, so I'll talk about it.
Right.
I don't live in the past. I don't try to relive all those things back then. I never look back, because when you're looking back, you never see what's coming to hit you in the face next. So, but yeah, it was good telling you. It was a good story. Good to talk about, but it's that was a past life.
Right, right.
So,
well, let's talk about real quick. Let's talk about your love for animals and hunting and all of that. When did you, I guess you obviously grew up hunting and fishing and doing all the outdoor stuff, but what, is there a time of your life that you just, like, I guess, were more ate up with it than another time?
Yeah, so I did. I grew up, I was a river rat. You know, we every weekend in the summer, there was a place called Patrick Crossing. People call it Rock Creek. Patrick Crossing had different names, but it was over on the other side of the river from a place called Golson. It was China Springs. And we would go down there every weekend and camp. And I grew up down there on the river. I mean, I was fishing, and I was always surrounded by uncles and stuff. Like my Uncle Jerry, he fished a lot. And so I grew up around a lot of fishing and stuff like that, and hunting. Daddy always went 2 weeks a year to Colorado, went up there hunting, and Idaho, places like that. And so after he lost his shop, we ended up moving out to the country. That was when I was in seventh grade is when we moved out to the country. And we had 10 acres next to the Delmar, I believe it was the Delmar Ranch. And, I had been hunting with my daddy before down in Gatesville and stuff, but that was the first time that I was on my own. You know, I was in seventh grade and I was doing my own thing. And that's when I started shooting my own deer by myself. Daddy'd be at work, and I was shooting deer at the house and skinning them and gutting them, you know, quartering them up and all that stuff by myself. So that was when I was, you know, in seventh grade. And I remember one time I snuck my daddy's 270 Weatherby Magnum. It had a 4x12 Leopold scope on it. That was his gun. That was his Colorado gun. You don't touch it.
Right.
But I got tired of shooting that old 30-30 with them open sights because I couldn't reach out there and touch something. And I snuck that thing out of the gun cabinet because I knew he was at work. And I knew I'd take a beating if I did anything to it. Well, let me tell you what I did to it. I had me a board nailed up in a tree, and I had me a little ladder built where I could get up in there. And I started up – I had that gun strapped to my back with a sling on it, and I started up that tree. Well, I had a branch on that tree that I used to put my foot on to step up to the next branch, and that branch snapped off. Well, when I fell backwards out of that tree. Well, another branch hit me behind my legs and threw me into a backflip. So I'm flipping through the branches in that tree, and I landed on my butt, kind of like jammed my back. But luckily it was muddy, and I jammed my back, and that 270, it broke the strap off of it. It broke his sling, and then the barrel stuck in the mud right between my legs where I landed and compacted his barrel with mud and broke his sling. Well, I got the mud out of the barrel, but I couldn't make an excuse for that sling. I had to tell on myself, and I thought I was going to die. But I don't know. I guess he thought at least my son's out there hunting and not being an idiot playing video games. So he
I had a little mercy on that one, huh?
He let me slide. He just told me don't never touch my stuff again. Well, in a different set of words, but he told me.
Well, today, in the past years and nowadays, you hunt wild hogs and stuff like that. What is that? Tell us some stories about that.
So when I was in the Navy and I lived over here, I met a buddy that your daddy knows, Louie, and he actually got me. I always had the bulldogs. My daddy had bulldogs. My papa had the bulldogs, and I had the bulldogs. And I met Louie, and he hunted hogs with him. And that's kind of where I got my start. That was 25, 26 years ago. That's where I got my start. Me, him, and Janice went hunting and another buddy of his, and we was poaching. Technically, we was poaching. We was hunting over, and we're outlaws. You know, that's what outlaws do. So we went hunting over on the Pearl River. Well, back in them days, that's before the state took all that land back and all that. Well, them guys had them clubs, and when we was over there hunting on the club land, I didn't know what we was doing. I didn't care. We was catching hogs. So we catch a sow over there, and we tie her up, because that's the thing, too. So to get into some details about this, there's a manly way to do everything. So you can – anybody can go out there and turn dogs loose and go bay a hog and run up there and shoot it with your rifle or stick him. And nowadays I'm getting older and there's nobody that really cares about manliness anymore. So you're really working your butt off carrying them out alive and nobody cares.
Right.
Used to in the day, you catch a big boar hog and you tie him up and you carry him out of the woods and you put him in your pen. All your buddies wanted to come over there and see him. You know, that was a reward, you know. So it's not like that anymore. So times have changed. But anyway, back to the original part of this story. We catch this sow. We carry her back to the boat. And this was a little old boat. And it had a big 30-horse motor on the back of it, little old skiff. So you got to really, with a hog and four people in there and the dogs, you got to get a running starter. You're going to take on water in the back. You got to keep it moving.
Right.
Well, we're cruising down the Pearl River, and there's a game warden got another boat pulled over, and it's a federal game warden, and he's got a state game warden with him. And Louie says, "Hey, nobody pay him any mind. Just look forward." And we're looking forward, you know. He knows the tricks of the trade. We're looking forward. Well, this dude, Sean, turns around and waves at the game warden. And I'm like, thinking in my head, that ain't what he said. So next thing you know, this game warden leaves that dude, and we got a 30 wrapped out. I mean, we're wide open going up the Pearl as fast as it'll go in this little 14-foot skiff. And this cop pulls up beside us, his game warden, and he's got his lights on. He's telling us, move over, get over, like stop.
Yeah.
So we pull up. Well, the part of the story that gets interesting is I was done living back in Texas. I had came over here to visit, and we decided to go hog hunting. I went and bought a Mississippi. You know, there's a statute of limitations, I believe, on this. So I don't think if the wrong person's watching this, it's going to matter. And if it does, it's a cool story to get a ticket over. So he pulls us over. I had bought an in-state Mississippi hunting license with an expired military ID so that I could have a state, you know, Mississippi license without right. paying. Back then I was poor. I just got out of the military. I had to, you know, find ways to save money. So I, not that I'm not poor now, but I had to save money. So I bought that license illegally with an expired military ID. Nobody looks at the date on the ID.
Right.
And, he goes around the boat and everybody, he goes, all right, give it to me. He's wanting everybody's license. So I pull out my license. Everybody pulls. I don't even know.
She didn't even have a license.
The girl in the boat didn't have a license. We got a hog.
I played that girl card.
Yeah.
Like I didn't have anything to do with what they were doing.
We got a sow tied up in the front of the boat. She's up there raising hell, squealing and kicking her feet. We got dogs screaming in the boat trying to get to the pig. And we're all handing him our license. And there's a state and a federal game warden. Well, the federal game warden's the one doing all the talking, and the state guy's just standing back there watching. And he gets to my license, and he looks at it, And he says, so I had to give him my driver's license too. So I had to give him my driver's license and a Mississippi hunting license. And he looks at me and he says, where's it at? I said, where's what at? He said, you know what I want? I was like, oh, shit. So I pull out my military ID. Well, you know that's a federal offense. And I said, man, I'm going to the big house over this deal. And I just kept my cool. I didn't act nervous because I've been outlawing my whole life pretty much. And I said, I'm going to have to play this one off. I just kept my composure. I said, oh, you want my military ID? No problem, sir. And I pulled it out and I handed it to him. And he looks at it. That's all he wanted. He wanted to see I had a military ID. And I hadn't been out very long, so I looked the same.
Right.
And he looks at it real quick. He goes, that's what I wanted. He hands us all of our stuff back, so I knew I was golden. So I'm like, what's going to happen with this hog deal? So he asked Louie. He says, hey, bud. He said, where was y'all hunting at? He said, man, you know so-and-so. And this guy was a politician, the guy that he mentioned. And I won't say his name on here, but the guy goes, yeah, I know him. He said, well, you know, he's got that lease up here. And that he goes, yeah, where exactly is that lease at? And he goes, man, yeah, that's what I thought. He said, let me tell y'all something. He said, today's your lucky day. He said, we fixing to start cracking down on all these poachers. He said, because all these people that have these clubs and spend all that money, they're getting tired of y'all coming and hunting on their clubs. He said, we fixing to start cracking down. He said, so today is your lucky day. I'm going to let you learn from it. He said, and because y'all got this girl with you and y'all know how to have a good time with a girl, I'm going to let y'all go. Thank you, sir. And we cranked the boat up and we left. And
you saved the day.
I saved the day.
Now, if Janice wasn't there, I'd have been in the big house because, you know, if they had hauled us in, they was going to figure all that out.
So right.
She kept me out of prison. So I give her that.
Probably not the first time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. Well, along other than that, what about your animals you have today? You pretty much have a full out farm. Not pretty much. You have a farm. What's your farm look like?
So we live up there on her family property in the old house. That's where we live, and I've got my wild hogs up there. You know, and that's another thing nowadays. It's illegal to transport a wild hog. So anybody listening, those things are grandfathered. They were born there and raised there. But I got my wild hogs and my hunting dogs, my hog dogs and chickens and stuff like that. And then we about, you know, going on 3 years ago, we bought another 40 up the road up off 15. And it was an old farm. When I say old, like in the 1800s, old 1800s.
Really?
Or late 1800s. It was an old farm. It's got pecan trees. It had an old big orchard on it, and it's got a lot of hardwoods and stuff like that. So when I bought that 40, and it's surrounded by DeSoto National Forest, so I don't, me not being a people person, that's a perfect place for me to go and when I retire, to go and lay my head, and I don't have to deal with people. It's quiet, it's peaceful. I don't have neighbors. I don't have people encroaching on me.
Right.
I've got one guy that lives to the west of me that's got a 20 that joins halfway up my 40, and then he's got a 40 on the other side of that 20. So, he's the only person that you could call a neighbor, and we get along great. So, but back behind him, between me and him, that's 20 acres deep of forestry. So it's 9,000 something acres of DeSoto National Forest that surrounds me. I don't have any problems with people moving in on me and minding my business.
Right.
And over there I got my goats and some cows and stuff like that. But I went in there and fenced that whole place. I started out doing the perimeter. Her daddy helped me to do the clearing, to clear the property and get the fence lines cleaned up. And then I also paid some help to come in there with one of them mulching machines and grind a bunch of it. But after after we got that process done, I built that whole fence by myself. I mean, I dug every post hole by hand. I built the perimeter fence is all steel. I used drill stem, 2 7/8 inch drill stem for my post. I built all my H's. All my H braces and corner braces and stuff like that. But I dug every post on that place with a set of hand post hoe diggers and pulled that wire. And my oldest daughter, Casey, she did come one day and we had one run that she helped me roll out, and we stretched it. But other than that, for the most part, and Janice has helped a few times over there, but she's so busy with the gym and all her stuff that, you know, her time's, you know, valuable to her. So for the most part, I built that whole fence by myself, and then obviously I had to cross fence it and all that. So it was a lot. It was a lot to do, but, you know, when it's yours and you enjoy that kind of stuff and that's your livelihood, it doesn't seem like work. You
know? Right.
It's enjoyment. It's kind of like you working on these cars. I mean, it's not work to you because you love it and there's nothing more that you'd rather be doing.
That's right. Exactly. It's got to be rewarding, especially when you step back and look at the so-called empire that you've built, yeah. For sure.
Yeah, so I built a big entrance on the front of it that's got my brand, my 4F. We, you know, people that are in the know, it's F. It's not the 4F, it's the F4. But
we bought you one.
Thank you.
And your daddy.
Awesome.
The brand only works out like that. We were big into branding everything when I was growing up. You brand your cows, you brand your boots, you brand everything leather. So, I built a big entrance with a big overhead that you drive under when you come in, kind of Texas style.
Man, I think that's the coolest thing. When we went and raced in Texas, like the amount of ranches and farms and stuff that we passed that had the big openings and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then there was a guy, we stayed at his shop over in Texas. I don't really remember where exactly, but it looked like we were pulling into like Jurassic Park or something. Big stonework, really nice stuff. What does the 4F stand for?
Well, so that's my legacy. You know, I'm a Ferguson, so the F is for the Ferguson, and I've got four women. You know, I've got
three
my
women.
Wife. Three women. Four total people, three women. Myself and my two daughters and Janice. So that's, you know, being in Mississippi, I wanted to, you know, have a little bit of a Texas twist to my place. So I built the big entrance, and I built the brand out of pipe, and it's up on top of my overhead. And that's the legacy, you know. So the place is it's registered with the state as a farm, and for regular people, it's the 4F.
I got you. Well, man, that's awesome. I really appreciate you guys coming in and for the stories and everything like that. I've learned a lot. Some really, like I said, really, really good stories, and that branding right there just ties it all together. So, thank you again, Mr. Richard, for coming on. Miss Janice, thank you again for everything. And I think that's going to conclude this episode of Off the Gas and On the Mic.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you for listening to Off the Gas and On the Mic with Chase Holland. What'd you think about what you heard? Please follow for more content just like this.